You may be seated. We are ready to hear argument on our third case, D-2885, Meter Brady Management Corporation with Texas Motor Vehicle, International House of Williams Motors.
May it please the court, Mr. William Coffey will present argument for petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
My name is David Coffey, Justices. I represent the petitioners. The point on which writ is granted in this case involves the procedure to be followed when a member of a quorum of an agency abstains from voting. This issue is before the court on an agency order which was adopted by only two commissioners of the six-member panel. The Agency Enabling Act, which empowers the commission, however, provides that a majority vote of a quorum of the commissioners shall be required to adopt final decisions or orders. On the vote in question, the commission was able to convene the minimum quorum necessary of 4 out of 6 commissioners, but the commission vote on the order was 2-4, 1 against, and 1 abstention. Now, mathematically, with a quorum of 4, 2 affirmative votes is not a majority vote of a quorum, which is the statutory standard.
Not if you apply the rule of acquiescence, however.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And I have a few things to say about that. You want to talk about them now, or?
It's your pleasure.
All right, sir. At any rate, in our view, a vote of 3 in favor of the order would have been required, and we believe that the court below agrees with us on this. Thus, in our view, the order was adopted by less than the statutorily required majority. Now, as you noted, Justice, the court below has been persuaded to apply, apparently for the first time in this state, a common law doctrine known as the rule of acquiescence. This rule attempts to determine how to treat an abstention by one panel member in a close vote situation. In general, the rule provides that under certain circumstances, an abstention may be counted as a vote in favor of majority action. Now, while this rule has never been applied to agency action in this state, the court below has attempted to construe this abstention by the chairman, in our case, as a vote in favor of the majority, thus applying the third crucial vote. There are 3 reasons, basically, why we think this is improper, this application of the rule of acquiescence, and why we think it requires a reversal of the court below. The first reason is we believe there is substantial authority in this state for treating an abstention as a non-vote as opposed to trying to construe it as an affirmative vote. The second reason is if we are going to adopt the rule of acquiescence in this state, let's at least do it for the right reasons. We think the court below has been persuaded to a mistaken view of the record and a mistaken view of the law on when and under what circumstances you apply the rule of acquiescence. Finally, we think that application of this rule to agency action, at least in this state where we have a very strong separation of powers principle that applies between the legislative branch and the judicial branch, that to essentially try to do anything with an abstention other than what it actually is defined as being, and that is a voluntary or intentional act of refraining from involving oneself in a vote. To try to do anything other than construe it as that and construe it as something different leads to separation of powers problems in the sense that the judiciary is, in effect, substituting its judgment for that of the agency, of the abstainer, and thus of the agency. Now, on this first point about the authority that is available in this state to apply to this situation so that we treat an abstention essentially as a non-vote as opposed to an affirmative vote, we've cited a number of cases, the Alamo Heights case, the Nall case. These cases essentially were cited for the proposition that one simply does not count an abstention. One doesn't try to turn it into an affirmative vote. There are more important principles involved.
Why do you count for purposes of establishing a quorum?
Why do you count? Well, that's a good question, Justice Cornum. In this case, we're dealing with a specific statute, I was going to talk about the Etheridge case for just a moment. The Etheridge case was a 1920 or perhaps 1930 Supreme Court case. It was a Commission of Appeals case that was adopted by the Supreme Court, and it involved the issue of whether the statutory standard, two-thirds vote of a council, could be construed as two-thirds of those present and voting, a quorum being present, which is one of the arguments that we've had in this case. What the Supreme Court said in that case, and this almost echoes the separation of powers principles that I was discussing earlier, what they said is that when we construe a legislative grant, in this case to a municipality as opposed to an agency, we're going to construe it strictly against the recipient of the grant of power. They're going to be required to strictly construe their statutory authority, strictly comply it, and we're going to require an affirmative showing that the exact percentage, which is required to vote for something, that the exact percentage voted for it. There was no attempt in that case to apply some rule of acquiescence or acquiescence principle. They strictly construed it and said, we're not going to allow a reduction, basically, an arbitrary reduction of the size of the council so that you can have a reduced vote. And when you look at our statute, the Motor Vehicle Commission Code, what you find is by law, the code consists of six commissioners. That's section 202 of the code. It requires a majority of that commission. It says the commission. A majority of the commission to become a quorum. That's section 208A of the code. And then, of course, you have the statutory section that's under review here, 308G, which says it requires a majority vote of that quorum to adopt an order. So we don't think that you can have a quorum of less than four, basically, under this statute, because if you apply the principles of the Etheridge case, you have to strictly construe this stuff, recognize it for what it is, not apply fictions to it. So I don't think you can have a quorum of less than four under the statute.
So you could have six commissioners meeting, three abstaining, three voting, and they couldn't conduct any business.
Would you give me the facts again? Three, four?
Six commissioners.
Yes, sir.
Present, three abstaining, and three voting, and for all practical purposes, they could not conduct any business.
Well, if you try to apply the fiction that you can reduce the quorum, essentially, by the abstainers, then you would not have a quorum to begin with. Under our view of the statute, you have to have four to have a quorum, so you could not do business at all under that scenario. If you apply that fiction, if you treat it as a non-vote, which is what we're proposing, then essentially you have your quorum of four, because a quorum is designed as a majority of any legislative body.
But if you have your full membership, as Justice Carter was alluding to, if you have your full membership present, three of them choose to acquiesce in what the other three want to do, isn't it a little ludicrous to say, hey, you can't conduct any business because three of you are abstaining, you're not participating in this vote?
Well, to buy into
that. In effect, that's what you're saying.
No, sir. To buy into that scenario, I first have to buy the proposition that you can construe an abstention as an acquiescence, and I don't buy that proposition.
How would you construe? What would happen to the commission if all six members showed up? If all six members had been present on this application, three of them abstained. Chairman and two of the others present.
Yes.
And exactly the parties who did vote voted the way they voted. What would be the outcome? You had your full six members present, and instead of having four with the chairman abstaining, you had three abstaining. The vote was 2-1. What would the outcome be?
2-4, one against, and three abstaining.
Right.
In our view, the minimum quorum that you can have under the statute is four. I think that was even expressed at the commission meeting. that day.
We're not talking about a quorum. We're talking about all six, the full membership.
You still have to talk about a quorum because it requires a majority vote of a quorum, sir, to pass an order. That's the statutory standard.
Where does that leave you?
Where that leaves you is with a quorum of four under our view of the statute, and you would have, yes, that's correct. You would have all six commissioners, essentially. You have three of them voting. You have three of them electing not to vote. However, they are all present, taking part for purposes of quorum. So you have a quorum of four, and out of that, you have two votes for and one against, and essentially I think you'd have the very same situation that we have before you today.
You would construe those abstentions as negative votes?
No, sir, I would construe them as non-votes. I wouldn't count them
in the
calculation.
Then the commission would be paralyzed.
Well, if a commissioner chooses to abstain, sir, and makes a legislative decision, let's say, to that effect, then that's a political decision he's entitled to make. If it hamstrings the commission for one meeting, so be it.
Is the reason for abstention in the record?
No, well, that's where we get to the separation of powers issue, Justice Doggett. There are a number of facts which are well established in the record that you can view and impute a certain intent to the chairman in his abstention. The respondent's view, the fact that he voted essentially with the majority on some motions for rehearing, that suggests that he was acquiescing in the majority vote on December the 6th. We, the petitioners, have pointed to the fact that he voted for us on September the 13th, and that suggests that he wasn't in favor of majority action on December the 6th. He simply voted or abstained because it was commission convention to abstain. And that's established in the record, that the commission does have a convention, that the chairman only votes to break a tie. But we're all just guessing. We don't know what his intent was. All we know for sure is that he abstained. And abstention is defined as an elective act not to participate in a vote. To call it anything other than what it is, to try to construe it as an affirmative vote, we believe is substituting the judiciary's judgment for the legislative judgment.
Mr. Coffey,
and that's the separation of powers problem.
It makes no difference if you have the full complement of the commission in a meeting. It makes no difference if you consider abstention votes to be acquiescence or not if a majority of the quorum. If a majority of the quorum votes for the proposition. The only time it makes a difference is if less than the majority votes for the proposition. Give me a policy reason why an abstention should be given some sort of operative effect. And that's really the issue, whether or not an abstention should be given the power to control the outcome of a proceeding. And so that would assume a majority of people abstain if you've got all the commission there, or just a few people abstain if you only have just the bare quorum there, so you prevent an actual affirmative vote of majority of the quorum. Why should an abstention be given the power to affect that outcome?
Well, in the first place, I think the only time you're really giving the abstainer the power to determine an outcome is if you try to construe this vote as something other than what it was. We feel that by applying the rule of acquiescence,
if the abstention prevents a majority vote of the quorum, that is the power to prevent the proposition going forward. That either supports the proposition or defeats the proposition, depending on where those who vote, the majority of those, chooses to go.
Well, again, I guess that's really a separation of powers issue. It's a political decision that is going on under a subdivision of the legislative branch, if we accept the view that agencies are not a fourth branch of government, they're part of the legislative branch. That's a political decision. Anytime the judiciary tries to, by legal fiction, if you will, change that political decision and call it something other than what it is, then I think you have a separation of powers problem. That's the real issue here on the rule of acquiescence.
The legislature could have said
that it takes four votes for affirmative action, couldn't they?
The legislature could have easily said whatever voting standard they want. They could have said it needs to be four out of six, or they could have eliminated a quorum entirely and made it a straight vote, a majority vote out of the whole commission, whatever they wanted to do.
Well, my point is they could have eliminated the abstention problem and the acquiescence issue if they had required four affirmative votes. For example, on this court, our internal rules say before we'll grant an application for writ of error, we must have four affirmative votes, but we can conduct business on a quorum basis.
But
wouldn't that have solved the problem?
I think it would, as long as you make it clear that you can't, by a legal fiction, construe an abstention as an affirmative vote. In other words, I think it's implicit in the statute that the majority vote of a quorum has to be an affirmative vote of the majority. Anytime you apply legal fiction, and it could have just as easily happened to your court if there was some higher court looking down and saying, well, Justice Cornyn abstained, we'll just count him as an affirmative vote. If you don't get any more explicit than just saying affirmative vote, I don't think you're in any better shape than we are under our statute where it says a majority vote. But you're right. If it was understood by everyone that affirmative votes meant only those voting affirmatively, you know, for a particular proposition, then that would cure the problem. Absolutely. But what does affirmative vote mean? I thought it was real clear in the statute that majority vote meant they had to be affirmative votes. But now I find out there's a common law doctrine called rule of acquiescence that allows, by legal fiction, a court to tell an agency what it really meant, what its vote really meant. That its affirmative act of not voting, abstaining, somehow constituted a vote with the majority.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready for argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Douglas Frazier, Mr. Joe Greenhill Jr. will present argument for respondent. Mr. Frazier will open.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Douglas Frazier on behalf of the Motor Vehicle Commission. First point that I'd like to make is our position is we generally agree with the Court of Appeals. Nothing prohibits the application of this principle that abstention should be regarded as acquiescence with the majority. We are familiar with the Texas cases. We have studied those same cases. We don't think that those cases apply to prohibit the Court of Appeals' decision in this case. The Court of Appeals read those cases as well and didn't feel that way either. Secondly, there are good public policy reasons. Once you get to the point of saying, well, there's nothing in the state law, in the law of the state of Texas, that prohibits us from applying this acquiescence doctrine, then the question I think Judge Enoch had it correct is, what is the public policy involved? Why should we employ this particular policy in the state? Two of the justices here this morning have already figured out that it is not really possible to disregard an abstention. Judge Gamage and Judge Enoch, I believe, both mentioned that if you don't count an abstention, it has to count some way. You know, you've got this vote out there. If you don't count it with the majority, then you're counting it against the majority. So if by doing this, you're not substituting the court's judgment for what the agency did. You're merely interpreting what the agency did. Secondly, if you don't employ this acquiescence doctrine, then a minority of an agency, as the court was pointing out in questions, can, by its inaction, block the action of the agency. And I think probably the best reason is that, you know, we sat around and tried to figure out why this might be a bad doctrine, why it might be a good doctrine. One of the possible reasons is, well, it could encourage members of a commission not to vote on an issue. To the contrary, in fact, I think it encourages them to take a stand. If they know that their inaction is going to be considered with the majority vote, regardless of how small that majority might be, then they're going to know that if they want to oppose something, they've got to take that action. Now, they've got to take some affirmative action.
Why shouldn't an agency be a, why shouldn't members who choose to abstain be deprived of the authority to do that by our, as Mr. Cox says, legal fiction of the acquiescence? Let's, actually, I don't see how a minority can prohibit an action of the court. You had two people who, for some reason or other, decided not to be at this commission meeting. So they affected the outcome. And then all you have is one person who abstained.
That's hardly a minority
because he needed two people to be absent and he needed somebody else to vote against. So a majority of the commission actually affected the outcome of this case, not the two that voted for it. But my comment is, why, if I'm, whatever my responsibility is, why should I be a decision maker, and I choose, for whatever reason, not to vote on the issue, be deprived of whatever effect that is by a court coming in and saying, we're just going to say you acquiesced in the majority. Why should I have the power to abstain and do whatever damage that does?
Well, I don't think that adopting that rule would take away that power. What adopting that rule does is just interpret what that means when you exercise your right to abstain. And if you have, I think there are certain limitations to abstention.
I guess my question would then be, why does it mean anything?
Well, because it has to mean something. It's either voted, if it's voted in the way that the petitioners would like to have the court count the vote, then there are not enough votes. So the abstention has killed the proposition.
In this
as
case,
far as
if
that.
The chairman were not acquiescing, he could have voted against it and created a tie, which would have effectively killed it temporarily, at least, until you had the full commission present, or a larger majority of the commission
in fact,
present. He could have gotten a contrary result simply by casting his vote against.
In fact, there are a number of other things that he did that indicate that he was in favor of this action. He could have left the room, which would have killed the quorum, and they couldn't have taken the vote. As you said, he could have voted to create a tie, which would have effectively killed the measure for that purpose. He signed the final order, and that was a key in the Ohio case, the Vatican case against Alton.
So isn't that pretty strong evidence of acquiescence?
That he agreed with it. He certainly could have refused to do that. And then finally, probably the strongest evidence is, though, this very issue was raised in the motion for rehearing by these petitioners, and he voted to deny that motion for rehearing. There's strong evidence in this case that it ought to be applied to this fact situation, I think.
But let's suppose the chairman did all of that to make whoever it is, the International House of Wheels, think the chairman liked their position. But he really didn't want them to know he was going to vote against them. So he just chose to abstain, knowing that that would keep the permit from issuing. What is the public policy reason that would say courts ought to step into that circumstance and say you can't, official over here to start responsibility voting, we're not going to let you hide behind an abstention?
Yeah, I think that's the public policy. I think you hit on it, Your Honor, is that these members ought to have a duty to vote. And if they have a reason to abstain, it's a personal interest in the matter or some thing like that, then perhaps a different rule should apply where they don't, their abstention won't count in favor of the action if they have a public reason or a personal reason to disqualify themselves from this vote. But otherwise, they should have a duty and they should know what it means when they choose to exercise that duty.
Absolutely.
The court can take...
Excuse me, go ahead.
You know, the court can take the position that it counts as a negative vote or it won't count with the majority.
Counsel is correct that any interpretation that we give to this particular provision will be defining the meaning of the vote necessary for action for any adjudicatory action taken by the commission. Not just the type of action that we have presented here today.
Yes, for final orders. It has to do with all final orders are required by the same statute to pass by a majority vote.
Is it appropriate then for us to consider the way we would handle this matter if it were in front of a court of appeals and a judge recused himself or herself from that proceeding?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's an analogous situation.
Why not?
Well, first of all, if you're talking about a panel of the Court of Appeals that just was in the Hayden case, you only have three members. So you don't have any majority with which the one abstaining can be counted to have acquiesced. I'm not sure about all those prepositions. But I don't think it would apply to the courts. And, in fact, the courts are under constitutional and statutory other provisions, and you certainly have to look at each provision separately. I've used my time and part of Mr. Greenhill's.
Any other questions?
Permission.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I intend to be very brief. I would like to back up just for a moment and state what this case is about. This case involves the application by my client, Mr. and Ms. Denny Turnbow, for a license to sell Honda motorcycles in Clear Lake, Texas. It was opposed by two competitors, one Pasadena Honda, 14 miles away over in Pasadena, and Galveston Honda, 29 miles away on Galveston Island. After some agitation, as you can tell from the record, the commission involved in this case did determine that the granting of this license was in the public interest, that there would be a considerable public convenience in terms of providing consumers an alternate place to shop for goods and services, that the granting of this license would enhance competition and would not harm the other competitive dealers. With respect to the point on which the court has granted the writ of error, I would first say that it's been the consistent position of my client that with respect to this particular statute, you look at this statute and see what is required, and in light of what is required, in light of the facts, you don't even have to get, in our view, to the doctrine of implied acquiescence. Because in this statute, two things are required. One is a quorum. That's always true of all boards. I represented a board for 20 years, and sometimes hard to get a quorum. But once you get a quorum, you have the power to act. So you have to have a quorum. In this instance, there was a quorum of four. The second thing you have to have is a majority vote. In this instance, the vote was two in favor, one against. Now, that is a majority vote. Certainly a majority of those present and voting. So under this statute, we would argue, simply as a matter of statutory interpretation, without even getting to the doctrine of implied acquiescence, that the requisite requirements for board action were present, that is a quorum of four, and secondly, a vote of two to one in favor.
Would one vote have been sufficient if everyone else had abstained?
No, sir. I think it requires a majority vote. One is not a majority. One and one is all alone.
Even though everyone else, if there were one affirmative vote and everyone else abstained, would that be sufficient? That would be a majority of those voting?
As I understand it, it takes a majority vote. So you'd have to have at least two affirmative votes. That's my construction of this particular statute.
And as the Court of Appeals construed it then, applying in a totally different fact situation, your client could be denied its license to sell motor vehicles in the state of Texas then by a vote of two people out of the six members of this commission?
Be denied, let's say...
A revocation of your license.
If there were two voted against...
If there were two people that voted in favor of it and everyone else abstained, the law that, if we follow the law announced in the Court of Appeals, your client could have his license revoked by a vote of two out of six.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm following that. If there were two in favor
of
revoking the license?
Yes, and no one, everyone else abstained.
Under the doctrine of the Court of Appeals, under the doctrine of implied acquiescence, I suppose that would be correct. I would like to address the question that the Judge Gamage asked, and that is the question of if you had two in favor, one against, and three abstaining, what would be the result? And the answer is you would have a quorum present, which is a quorum of four, and you would have a majority vote of two in favor, one against, and three abstaining, so the action would carry under our reading of the statute.
Well, this is true, I think, but it's also consistent with what the Court of Appeals and Judge Doggett has said.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, that's true.
If you had two to revoke your license and four abstaining, whether it's under your argument that we don't need to reach implied acquiescence, or you're simply your approach that the law requires a quorum to be present and a majority of those voting to take an action one way or the other.
That's true.
You lose your license either way, right? If they, two of them vote to revoke.
Yes, sir. The second question, or question you asked, Justice Doggett, was whether or not what the record had to say about the vote of the particular abstaining member. And the Court of Appeals stated that the record supported the concept of the abstaining member being in acquiescence with the will of a majority. And I think the record in this case is clear that that was correct. At the not only because at the initial meeting, if he wanted to vote against, he could have, but more clearly, while this matter was still before the commission, there was a motion for rehearing, and the vote was two for granting a motion for rehearing, two against, and Commissioner Burton cast a deciding vote to deny the motion for rehearing in the face of the petitioner's argument that the matter had not been adopted by an appropriate number of votes.
Did he not also sign the final order, which you assume if he didn't think it was a valid order, could have declined to do so?
I think that's right, Your Honor. The record will state that. I know in this particular situation, the order has to be signed by the executive director, whether the commission signs, whether the chairman signed the order. I think he does.
Does he even sign orders that he votes against?
Yes.
So it's really ministerial as far as his signing. It doesn't have very much meaning in terms of indicating whether he acquiesced or not.
It's only ministerial if it's a valid order, though.
Well, that's true. I didn't mean to suggest that it did. Finally, I would like, and this is more difficult, you ask about the Court of Appeals. And what I would say is, my view is that you could have a statute that you have a situation where the statute affirmatively requires a specific number of votes. I represented the Texas Optometry Board for 20 years, and too long, but it, under its statute, it had a nine members, a quorum of five, and it took five affirmative votes to revoke a license, and five affirmative votes. And that particular statute, the doctrine of implied acquiescence, wouldn't apply because the legislature specifically states a number of five. You can achieve that either by specific language or by court interpretation. As I read the Hayden case,
I
this
think
court...
You're getting a little bit on that. So go ahead.
No,
to
carry that concept forward to the Hayden case, as I understand it, this court is a matter of interpretation or construction of that statute and the language which construed that statute to require a specific number to, did it by judicial construction so that the doctrine would not come into play. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Justice Doggett, I'd like to go back to one of your questions to Mr. Greenhill, if I may, for just a moment. You asked him whether or not one affirmative vote under one scenario and then two affirmative votes under another scenario and the rest abstentions would constitute a majority vote of a quorum. Obviously, under the statutory language, majority vote of a quorum, where the minimum quorum that's available, that's possible under the law, is four, two votes won't do it, one vote won't do it, you have to have three. That's the minimum that you can have for a majority vote of a quorum when the law clearly says that we have to have a six-member commission, when the law says that you have to have a majority of that commission, not some hypothetical commission as your quorum, then majority vote of the quorum has to be three. Public policies.
What weight would you give to the vote of the chairman on rehearing. In other words, he voted to not allow a rehearing.
Justice Spector, we can speculate all day long what is in an abstainer's mind. That is the whole separation of powers problem that we have here. I would not give that any consideration. He could have voted on motion for rehearing for any one of a thousand reasons. He could have voted because he was tired of the case. He could have voted because he knew he didn't have enough votes under any circumstance to get what he wanted out of that case. He could have done it because there was another defect completely outside of what we're talking about here and granted the motion for rehearing for that purpose.
You don't think it's a vote of acquiescence?
No, ma'am, absolutely not. And that is the problem. You simply cannot sit up here and look at little bits and pieces of the record and try to impute to the chairman some specific intent to acquiesce. And in fact, that is absolutely the opposite reason for why the rule of acquiescence was contrived by the judiciary. The reason they developed it to begin with was not to impute an implied intent to acquiesce with the majority, but to force acquiescence on someone that they perceived was maneuvering politically and refusing to exercise their duty to vote. So the Court of Appeals applied the rule for all the wrong reasons. They essentially said that we're going to apply this because the chairman, we're going to imply the intent in the chairman to acquiesce with the majority because if he had wanted to defeat the measure, he could have voted to create a tie. But that's not the reason. Essentially, they're saying we're going to, for a rule designed to prevent the frustration of governmental action, we're going to apply it because the chairman abstained and thus prevented the frustration of governmental action. It's a complete non sequitur. It was applied for the wrong reasons in this case. Public policy. You have two. Yes,
I'm sorry. No. If it's a majority vote of the quorum, if the statute doesn't say an affirmative vote of the majority, could the statute be read to say that it's a, the vote counts if a majority of the quorum vote, so that you have a situation where three of the four voted, two voted for, one against, so you had a votes cast by a majority of the quorum. Would that not accomplish the purpose without giving acquiescence to abstentions and still be consistent with the language of the statute?
I want you to read the Etheridge case. I apologize because I didn't find Etheridge until Thursday. I filed a pre-submission brief on Thursday afternoon as soon as I found the case. I never had a chance to argue it at the Court of Appeals. I never even had a chance to cite it in my writ of error. It's State Ex Rel Rhea versus Etheridge. It's cited in the pre-submission brief. In that case, Justice Enoch, this Supreme Court itself answered that question directly in 1930. They said that we are going to construe these statutory voting standards strictly. We are not going to play games with them. We're not going to apply legal fictions. When the legislature says it takes a specific percentage of an elected body or any other type of legislative body to pass a measure, we need an affirmative showing of that precise percentage. You cannot, by fiction, reduce the size of the legislative body to allow yourself a smaller majority to prevail. You simply can't do it. Now, I know that that conflicts with the City of Alamo Heights case. To some extent, it conflicts with the Nall case. And frankly, I don't know how at least the Alamo Heights case, which came after the Etheridge case, I don't know how it managed to survive review by the Supreme Court, because in Alamo Heights they did precisely the opposite of what they did precisely what the Supreme Court said you couldn't do in Etheridge. But to answer your question, this whole fiction of trying to construe a percentage of an elected body as those present and voting as long as you have a quorum was struck down completely by the Etheridge case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third clause. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise.
Thank you.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.